Welcome to Faith Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
And we are discussing today the problem of all problems, the problem that will not go away. It will get worse over time. And so we want to try to unearth some of the theological rootings to this problem and perhaps give some helpful advice on what to do.
And that problem would be
climate change.
Climate change.
And everything that comes along with it, which is quite a bit. So human beings have lived in such a way that we have lived ourselves into an earth that is no longer interested in sustaining that way of life.
Wow.
So the earth is going to repair some of the damage that we've done. Mm-hmm. And because we are along for the ride, that is going to impact us. The earth don't care about our feelings and what we've built and all of those things. The earth says, no, we're going to get this right. And you had your time. And now it's now someone else has to step in.
And the earth has shown us what it's capable of doing when we are all forced to change some of our habits. So even though climate change is treated politically, the bottom line reality is that there is something going on, and humans have directly contributed to that. And when we were quarantined or at home at the top of the pandemic, which really severely limited a lot of people's habits and movements, we began to see how quickly Earth could repair itself if we are not keeping our regularly scheduled program. And I think the lesson there is that we can't think or rely that on another act of God, if you will. We can't think that it's going to be another pandemic. We don't know what it might be that could severely impact our behaviors. But the truth of the matter is that climate change is having an impact increasingly on our day-to-day life. I think it used to be seen as an abstract problem. You know, it's happening, but is it really happening near me or to me? And I believe that we've closed the gap on that abstract view. It's happening in real time. It's happening in our communities, and it's happening to people, everyone, but it's also happening to people who are the least prepared or the least able in so many different ways to repel its impact. So this is very much an issue that this is our kind of thing. We need to talk about this and get deeper into whether or not we are doing what we thought we should do, maybe theologically, but even scientifically, if we're at so-called at the top of various food chains, what does it mean if we really gonna end up messing up the food chain? Right. That's where we are.
So this is definitely not a Christian problem or even a strictly theological problem, but there are theological influences. When you consider that Christianity, Judaism, and Islam are the three major world religions. Now, there are others. We've talked about those previously, but if you consider the impact and the spread of those three, you can surmise that it's significant in terms of who's been exposed to this. And the three of them share a common origin story. The Quran is different, but it comes out of the same tradition. But in the book of Genesis, first chapter, verse 28, that verse reads, God blessed them and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. This verse has been the guiding principle for people who have been in power and also following some of these religions. And the understanding of the verse, specifically when it says, fill the earth and subdue it. And then it feels like people have read and also have dominion. And even though the verse says over the fish of the seas and birds of the air, and people seem to stop it, have dominion, subdue the earth and basically have dominion. And that is not really what the text intended.
What is that, proof texting?
Right. So Jürgen Moltmann, who is a theologian, calls the misinterpretation of that have dominion portion and subdue it as a crisis of domination.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with Moltmann, who believes that humans are the problem here.
Mm-hmm.
Really, the problem is when you, as a human being, worship an almighty God, and then you also believe yourself to be the image of that almighty God, mm-hmm. then you can successfully leverage this Genesis account to believe that you also have that almighty God's power or mm-hmm. a portion of that power. So mm-hmm. that becomes dangerous when you interpret a verse that says subdue the earth and it has words in it like dominion, because your dominion would look like an almighty dominion. And that is not necessarily the case with us.
Yeah. Christian capitalism has entered the chat. This becomes especially problematic when, as most issues rise to some sort of political dichotomy, we have a political force, you know, in our country and in Western nations writ large that tend to think that this opening to subdue the earth and to hold dominion and ultimate power over it means that it furthers their business opportunities and practices, their opportunities to operate within a capitalist system that is, you know, and it's in operation all over the world. You can't talk about one without the other, because we're not just talking about people who play into the big three religions globally mm-hmm. who might be misreading this. Following behind some of our earlier work, we know that if we group things together, there's a huge potential for misreading here, where capitalism and unfortunately supremacist idealism and this theology intersect, where it can become increasingly difficult to rein in, let's say, a neo-Christian capitalist structure that doesn't really want to be controlled. And we're not talking about so much the Amazons, even though that's important. We're talking about what used to be 25 years ago, people were rising up against a Walmart. You know, what mm-hmm. was it doing to supply chains and logistics and the availability of goods and the movement of goods around the earth? And now we're talking about not just the Walmarts, not just the Amazons, but the humans, as it were, we have a problem with instant gratification. And we have an issue with the underbelly of globalization. So when this conversation first started, when, I mean, honestly, we were children, and it was be ready for a global world, be ready to interact, speaking other languages, going to new places, new markets, and understanding their way of life and how we can impact and an improvement selling our goods. When we looked at that economically, almost instantly, the environmentalists had something to say. They had something to say about moving around the earth and depleting resources. They had something to say about the use of fossil fuels to move those resources to and fro. They had something to say about the impacts of creating those creating finished products out of those resources and the impact that would have on local communities. And now here we are at the precipice of this 2030 guideline over climate change for the most industrialized economies, and we're wringing our hands because we didn't want to deal with this part.
And so it's a problem for all of us, because you mentioned Amazon. That convenience is something that we've become accustomed to. Like when Absolutely. I order my thing, I want that thing. Like I don't, if I can get it same day, I want it same day. And
Absolutely.
Before that, as you also raised, the issue of globalization arose, where I want strawberries in the winter. Mm-hmm, strawberries mm-hmm. don't grow in the winter, but they grow somewhere in the winter.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. the cost of those strawberries getting to you out of season is incredibly high for the earth. The fuel that's extracted, the fuel mm-hmm. that it is burned to get there, the materials that are used to make the vehicle that got that to you. We have, for the sake of convenience, contributed to a problem that it may be difficult to walk back. And like you said, it's not that this is a theological problem exclusively, but theology and capitalism happen to agree on this, that mm-hmm. we have all the authority and power endowed to us so that we have the right to have these strawberries in winter, or we have the right to have that package when we want it, even though I'm getting another package tomorrow and I'm ordering another one the next day. I'm not even consolidating them because I want the one I want when I want it.
Right. And well, when we, you know, people have their views and, you know, lessons learned from the quarantine period that for a great number of us stopped our daily pattern. So some people were already ordering groceries or ordering from Amazon for materials or ordering clothes and shoes. But when we no longer, it seems, and this is not scientific, this is just my observation, when we were all forced to be in the house and figure out what to do with our time and figure out what to do with our free, not just our free time, whatever that was, but also there was money around. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're not on your regular commute, you didn't get your coffee, you didn't buy your lunch that day, you didn't go get gas that day, you're working from home. So I feel like one of the things that we don't talk about being our part of our American culture is consumerism. And it was crystallized for me during the quarantine where culturally Americans needed to shop and needed to consume. They needed to buy something. And I don't think you think about that every day when you're in your regular habit. But when you're not in your regular habit and out of anxiety and stress, we're just talking about how some people responded to having their wings clipped. Now you're sitting on websites and you're ordering because you missed the mall or you missed going out to dinner. So you ordered curbside and you're hearing these varying opinions. Please don't cut off being a consumer, being a shopper, because those are people's jobs or we have things in the pipeline and we want to get goods to you. But the flip side is you've been hearing steady in a drumbeat, you know, for years now, for decades now. Watch your habits. Watch your commutes. Watch how you use your cars. You know, now we have Teslas on the market. I remember when that wasn't there. We had Prius emerging. We had people, you know, toying with other fuel resources for cars. Because what? Because we've gotten used to hopping in our cars and going wherever we want to go. So we're at a point in the conversation where we're no longer just talking about what is the big thing that needs to happen, because there are a few big things that absolutely need to happen. We are also talking about what the individual is willing to do to repel the impacts of these changes. And, you know, by individuals, of course, we're talking about self, but we're also talking about the organizations and the groupings we find ourselves in. So yes, this is a conversation for houses of faith, because though even those organizations generate and contribute, and we have to figure out how to mitigate and how to minimize our impacts altogether.
And it's important. We want to make sure that we're not, as you just said, we're not putting all the onus on this on the individual. I mean, it is our organizations. It's our systems. Senator Joe Manchin right now is holding up and not going to agree to the most important part of this infrastructure bill, which is the climate agenda piece. Senator Joe Manchin owns a coal company. He has a vested interest as a representative of the people of West Virginia to look out for their needs. But because his needs supersede theirs, the rest of the country, then the rest of the world will lose this critical piece out of this legislation. So yes, we can do the things, but it's not all on us to do. We have to also make sure, and we'll talk about this a little bit later. So what is happening currently, we saw this with Hurricane Katrina. So
yes,
when Katrina hit, over a million people left New Orleans. I think it was 1.6 million people left. Only 900,000 of them returned, which means you call that a delta of 700,000 people who migrated due to those climate impacts. Climate migration and displacement is something that is currently underway because in some cases they can't afford to return to a place, and in some cases they can't afford to leave a place. And so that's where communities of color will be hit first and hardest. And not just communities of color, also poor people will not be able to escape some of these impacts, particularly along coastal regions particularly on the West Coast, where the West Coast is going to be perpetually on fire. These things, people need to be able to move. And when they move, they don't have the option always to return. So climate migration is also one of the reasons why you're seeing that crisis at the border from people coming from South America due to climate impacts. And you're seeing this huge influx of people who are coming north to try to escape what we all can see is coming.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the climate migration. That's happening not just in the United States. That's happening everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Climate gentrification. So we know what gentrification is in from many of our cities, but climate gentrification is you taking your money. Let's say you live in New York and you take your New York salary and you move it to Buffalo. Now, you may live in New York, but you're going to buy up the land in rural New York, where the land is much cheaper. That, just like in our cities, is going to price those residents out of that area. They're not going to be able to afford to live there. Once you come, you don't just come with your bags. You come with your stores and all of the things that you need to live. And those stores know that you're willing to pay that money. And so the cost of living rises in that area, and it causes people not to be able to afford that. Climate gentrification is currently underway. And that's not even a bad idea. Like, if you're unable to sustain, let's say you're in Miami. Miami's going to be underwater in like 20 or 30 years. Miami's
going
to be submerged. You want to move that further up into the panhandle or further up into Georgia, Mississippi, Alabama, because you have the money to buy the land. The land is cheap right now. Why not buy it?
Mm-hmm.
I can't even argue with that. In fact, I'm probably going to do the same thing because that's the smart move.
Relative to your ability to do so. But a great number of people don't have the ability. And then again, the system within which we are trying to make these moves and these decisions compels us to offer those types of resources for a corresponding cost. So whomever is holding the land when a greater number of people come looking for it, come looking for the accommodation, is going to make the money from renters or from selling what they have to people who want it. Speaking about the cities, one thing that you've seen, and do not minimize climate's impact on people making decision to live, let's say, inside of a beltway, inside of a highway system, closer to a train system or a bus system versus outside. The displacement that is happening for low-income people or communities, historic communities of color that were, let's say, co-located next to these types of resources, not because it was going to be so great for us. It helped move a working labor population to various jobs, and it also helped to, let's say, isolate those communities from communities that had cars and the resources that you could get to with cars. Now in 2021, you're seeing people of means coming into communities, buying homes that had been historically owned by, let's say, other people or basically I'm saying Black people. I have to say this because we've been pushed into these different areas of cities and we've had to deal with whatever urban issues come along with that. When people of means come with the cash, displacing you, not on purpose, oh, get out of your house, but see, I've bought a house on your block for hundreds of thousands of dollars more than what you paid. Now your taxes are untenable because you have a controlled income, or you know, you have no use. You were asking for better schools, but they definitely gave me bike lanes when I came, or they gave me a Whole Foods, but you really needed something more like a Save-A-Lot, you know, for the price point. These things begin to change the community as we know it. And when those people get displaced without the resources to participate wherever they end up, that has a significant impact, not just on us as far as location, but that has an impact on culture. What we just said about the people leaving New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina, we're talking about straight up move you and your goods to a safer place for what we thought was going to be a short amount of time. But now we see that people ended up permanently resettled in Atlanta, in Houston, in, you know, Los Angeles to some extent, in Washington, D.C. That can't be that way all the time. And what those people ended up taking, you know, on the good side, the exposure to New Orleans culture had to be great for people who were experiencing such a large group of people at one time. But that's going to be very significant to our communities if we are not only displaced, but for lack of a better term, watered down when we resettle in other places. That is something that has to be considered, you know, even in, let's say, for instance, the DC area. You have people who are living in one of the 8 wards in the city. And all of a sudden, because of a lack of availability of housing, a lack of availability of viable schools and viable jobs, they have to move out to other places. It's not just our phenomenon, but what does that mean when you find yourself living 45 minutes to 2 hours away from what you're used to? With no resources to get back to it, not able to buy the foods that have been staples in your, a staple in your diet, not able to interact culturally in a way that you've grown accustomed. All of that will be impacted by climate.
Yeah, those beauty supply stores don't exist in the places that you're going to go, and you got to do something.
Absolutely.
We also will see an increase in infectious disease frequency. So COVID is not going to be the last time we go through something like this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just because of the destruction of habitats cause other things and other interactions, which would not naturally occur. And so when that happens with increased frequency, you start to get some of these diseases that are new to us that we would have never otherwise encountered.
Right.
And so it takes time to work through to get whatever immunities we have through vaccinations or whatever. It takes time. And so that's going to be the way it is, which is ridiculous to me why so many employers are fighting what we've demonstrated for almost 2 years, that you don't have to physically be in the office to actually to get the job done. I mean, people with no imagination want to bring people back into the office. That not only reduces the productivity gains that you've achieved in the last 18 months or so, but it also impacts the climate problem that we all share. Like, you want to put all these people back on the road to come to an office to sit there and do what? The same thing they was doing at home?
Nothing. Because dare I say, for everything that home might have been, sometimes that office culture, I know people have been slow to re-enter their offices physically for some of the non-physical stuff that was going on there, such as the culture working amongst different people, right? And it just gets to be a lot. We talk about people dealing with microaggressions and all of this, and I feel like everybody's in a heightened state of stress and anxiety. That's just a lot to have to try to juggle with other entities. But do not underestimate the seductive power of ego and power, you know, when considering why would an employer do X over Y? Because that's how it's been done. And our systems are only, let's say, new sorting and grouping systems. You still have a hierarchy. And what I've noticed is that a number of people are repelling change, and this has happened in with different issues, because they don't know what life looks like on the other side of those changes. They don't know where they land on the hierarchy. They don't know how much control they're going to have if they give into a change process, especially one so conceptually large as trying to walk back some of the impacts that we've made on our earth, on our planet, with our behavior. Trust and believe, if we have to go through various political and cultural and intellectual sorters to figure out how big of a problem it is, we're going to do the same thing almost painfully slow, trying to figure out what the actual solutions to these problems might be, or how we can, again, navigate in this playing field that we've created due to, you know, either inaction or the lack of power to implement the policies that we know could make a positive impact.
Leaders without imagination are going to fail, and in a big way, because there are a lot of them that don't have it. And to be fair, that's not everyone's gifting. Like, everyone cannot dream. And so some people actually need to sit through that training to tell them how to actually move in this new environment. That training doesn't exist yet because we're right all living it right now. So you can't send your manager, like, you could send them to project manager training. You can send them to PMP, but you can't send them to how to manage in a remote environment. Because that's just not a thing yet. And we're learning it. And so those who do lack the imagination to figure out a new way to even understand the data and say, hey, you know what? We've been more productive. Those are those who will struggle during this time.
And are struggling.
Yeah. So we've laid out very broad strokes, like what we can expect. This is not getting better. And that's the thing about this specific problem and why I say it's this important, because things that are legislated through policy usually can be undone. In this case, not only can it not be undone, this impacts everyone on the planet. Let's say Joe Manchin actually did the right thing and Kyrsten Sinema, let's say they did the right thing. And the United States went into a climate conscious future doing all of the things, tax rebates on electric vehicles, on solar panels, on renewable energies. And you get all of these benefits, but Russia and China are still going to do what they're going to do. Let's say India doesn't do it. This is the thing. It takes everyone to change.
Absolutely.
Now, I was talking to the count from the Brown Liquor Report. We were talking about this, and he pointed out the fact that we have struggled and failed to convince people that they need to put a piece of cloth on their face to protect those around them. People refuse to do that simple thing. Now, when they are faced with what is required to correct this other problem, what hope do we have that those people who could not put a mask on, who felt their freedoms were so violated, what hope do we have that they are going to want to make the adjustments, which to them would feel cataclysmic compared to a mask? That's just in this country.
I mean, yeah. I mean, so again, I just think that, you know, we're painting with broad strokes just to talk about the impact of the climate problem and the urgency with which it needs to be addressed. But it is no small thing, the impact of capitalism on the climate problem as well. And the point that you just made about, you know, even if the United States gets on the good foot, what about these other, you know, economies in these other countries? Truly, that is a manifestation of one of the biggest pitfalls to capitalism, is that every economy wants its day in the sun. Every economy wants to be prosperous because we are not the only people on earth. We are not the only people that want creature comforts. We are not the only people that want to imagine a comfortable lifestyle. And when we think about what that lifestyle costs in American dollars, we still are very overwhelmed with trying to imagine how other people in other cultures are, you know, making it on these smaller numbers, but the numbers are big for their economy, right? So they don't need to make the six figures that sometimes Americans need to make, depending on what metropolitan area they live in, just to make the bottom line of housing, clothing, shelter, transportation to and from work, you know, a dinner here and there, a movie night. For people in New York, six figures is going to get you something, but it might not get you all of everything that you might have thought you could afford on six figures. So it's hard to imagine those people in emerging economies in places such as China has its own billion people. India has its own billion people. What those economies and governments are willing to do. And we do need everybody to play in. But this was why it was so important what the United States did during the previous administration when it came to climate, because everybody's looking for a reason to step back. No, not me. I don't want to go first. I don't want to give it up. I don't want to make the sacrifice. So when the United States said to the Paris Accords, we out, that was a problem. And that was a problem because of the green light that it gave to leaders who, let's say, were not so completely sold out on having their financial interests come second to climate, They say, okay, good, we got more time because the United States is not on the ball. Even as we try to regain leadership in that area, we've lost 4 years in responding. Mm-hmm. We see, and you ask, what would these people who struggle with a mask, what are they going to do? I think part of the issue that is affecting people with the ongoing COVID saga and, you know, to vaccinate, to not vaccinate, to look out for others or just look out for yourself is that COVID kind of came through and either it so far, it either it's really affected you or it hasn't. So either you seem to have had it yourself, had a family member have it or unfortunately succumbed to it, or you knew directly of somebody, or none of that has happened to you. I think what the difference is with a climate situation, i.e. a Katrina, is that you cannot decide that that flood did not happen, that that displacement did not happen, that it did not affect you in some way. You know, even if you did not have a flooded out house, if your neighbor's house was flooded out, that's your relation. That's your understanding. If your church was closed, if you had a garden and your garden was destroyed, if your means of transportation was destroyed, these types of things bring it home for us. You can wrestle with it, but I don't think we're wrestling with the reality of the problem. We're wrestling with how someone perceives their contribution to the problem. This aches humans no matter what we're talking about.
I agree with you. Like, it's difficult to face that type of flooding or fire and say, no, this is not happening. And it bothers me that the people who did deny it have never come back on the record to say, hey, you know what? We called that one wrong. Like, that's never been a thing, even though it's obvious at this point. But the problem you're going to have is if I overlay a political map of the United States and you see where the blue states are, where the red states are, the bulk of those red states are in the interior of the country. Those are the people who also don't want to wear masks. Now, of course, everyone's mixed in and there's people, you know, right, everywhere. But the bulk of the interior of the country is also going to be the people who are least or last impacted by some of the coastal flooding, the fires, and all those things. They are buffered by where they are geographically. Now, they may feel it in other areas, like the cost of shipping to get goods to where you are, the droughts that will occur that will sweep across the plain states. But in terms of the major stuff that they are difficult to deny or explain away, they're going to get those last. And so because so many of the representatives from those states are the ones who are hampering our efforts to actually address this issue, I think it's going to just take us a long time to get there.
Well, one time for geography, they deal with flooding, let's say in the Midwest area, in the Midwest states, and they deal with it annually. They sometimes clock a flood and say this is that every 100 years level of destruction that we haven't experienced. Mm-hmm. They have other issues. It's like the United States has such a varied climate that, yes, you have had people being disingenuous about what it would mean to, let's say, limit offshore drilling because they live in the mountains and it won't look the same way to them. It's not their beaches getting messed up. You know, it's somebody else. You've had people pass the buck. You know, a Democrat controlled legislature or a Democratic governor might be able to hold that off for a while, only to pass it literally down 95 to their Southern GOP counterpart, who will say, sure, but maybe not right here. And that's when you start getting into the environmental justice issues where I want pain, but now I have to decide where it's going to be painful, where I'm going to put, you know, turbines, or where I'm going to drill, or where I'm going to dump, or whatever. And just like when you decided where highways should go, no one should be surprised if some of this, some of the more negative effects of the decisions that have to be made are going to, some people are going to be like, put it over there, put it near them. You know, they already have higher instances of cancer. They won't know the difference.
Yeah.
And you have examples of that. So I just think that this is where you make the argument or make the appeal for what the individual has to do, because I feel like enough individuals doing something does make a difference. And it's something discernible. At this point, we have to teach our children how to kind of get some of these things back and how to push some of this stuff back. Mm-hmm. The young lady, Greta
Thunberg.
Greta is so important because as a teenager, her argument was simply this: I don't have the power to vote. And the decisions that you are making are going to make it untenable for me to live in the world that you're leaving me to inherit. That was literally the young lady's argument. And she inspired so many other young people, but she sparked such a backlash because that's absolutely true. Mm. Absolutely. Every generation, we've been trying to convince the people, the powers that be, hey, don't do that because you're leaving that for your grandkids. Even now, we're dealing with boomers who have been told for generations, maybe I wouldn't mess with Medicare. Maybe I wouldn't, I don't know if I would fuck with, you know, Social Security. And now what's going on? They touched it. Yep. And, you know, we call this high scientific theory. You're going to fuck around and find out that if you deplete things before you need them or you try to hoard them for yourself, you're going to set off a chain reaction where you might not see the unexpected impact of, you know, what you've done. Because much like Ramses, listen, I don't think he ever intended for his son to die as he was trying to sniff out Moses and deplete his power. You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. He didn't. That was an unexpected impact of the decisions that he was making. This is the same thing.
Mm-hmm. So the future is bleak as we've painted it. And I think that we've done a fair reading of the information. But humans like hope. So what hope do we have in all of this? And led off with a misunderstanding of the Genesis passage. Mm-hmm. Jürgen Moltmann also says that in addition to the Imago Dei, humans being the image of God, humans are also the Imago Mundi, which is the image of the earth. And being both means you see things a little bit differently. That is that you don't dominate with God's almighty power, however you perceive that. That's not the role of the human being. The human being's role is to nurture, to care for, to cultivate those things that God finds important. Now, if God thought it important enough to create all of these things, then God would want to care for these things. And being the image of the earth also means that domination is not your role. Stewardship is your role.
Absolutely.
Connectedness is what we're called to, that we should be intimately connected with our planet and the things that happen and the things that are influenced and caused and how do we repair and all of those things as, if you want to see it this way, the appointed stewards of the environment. Now, you don't have to see it this way, but the thing is, it doesn't really matter because the earth is going to shake you off no matter what.
Anyway.
Yeah, so you might as well figure out a way to live as the earth continues to thrive, because as we've mentioned before, we are not ruining the planet. We are ruining humans' ability to live on the planet.
Absolutely.
The planet will continue. Life will go on. Unfortunately, our behaviors may take some types of life with it, but the earth will be fine. You will not. So what you want to do is try to figure out like how you're going to be fine in partnership with the earth. So it takes that recalibration of how we viewed our relationship to the earth in order to start to move in the right direction. So what do we do? Practical things.
Well, I feel like Black people have always been good at repurposing and reusing. Okay. So people call this recycling and such, but about that bag of plastic bags underneath your sink.
All of those bags.
Those old takeout containers that you washed, you did not throw away. These are small things, but like, I also think they're cultural. You know, we're not going to go out and keep constantly buying new Tupperware, all that. Mm-hmm. You know, these are small things, but I think we need to think about, again, the moves we make with our money. There has to be some sliding scale for the actual impact of, you know, our consumerism, our purchases, or whatever it's going to be. So I'm a huge advocate of us staying put as much as possible in our close-in communities. And I know that that is a bigger faceted issue than just worrying about, you know, our impact on climate. But I want to make an argument for us being co-located near transportation systems. We know that fossil fuels, it's not going to be able to be sustained. We don't know when. And honestly, the pain that we would feel if gas pumps stopped tomorrow, wars are going to start. But you got to get prepared. If you get ready, you know, if you stay ready, you won't have to get ready when something like that happens. So I'm a huge advocate of us staying close in, a huge advocate of us having knowledge of our transportation systems and to not overwhelm what these options could be. I am a huge proponent of food security, and people started pandemic gardens. I'm telling you, gave us back time that we didn't even know that we had. You know, mm-hmm. You didn't have to spend 2 hours on the highway commuting to your job for some of us. And our pandemic garden, me and my old roommate, we loved it. You know what I'm saying? But of course, here comes capitalism again, knocking on the door. But anything you can do to ensure your food security is going to be helpful in the long run.
You know, when we do these shows, we learn a lot of things. One of the things Yes. that I did not know, but I learned in preparation for this show regarding food security and how important that is. In 16th century England, what they would have is people who, like at the castles, they would have people who could sneak up to the castles and actually do harm to those who were inside. So what they found was, this grass is too high. We can't see who's coming in. So they started to cut the or manicure the lawns in mm-hmm. 16th century English castles. Because that was happening at the castle, it became seen as a sign of wealth. That if you can not only afford to have someone cut that lawn or mow that lawn, keep that low, but you also didn't have to use your land to grow food, you were pretty well off.
Wealthy. Mm-hmm.
So now if you think about in the 21st century, all of your HOAs, most of them will not permit you to garden on your land like you need to. Like you can't use your land for that because these HOAs are also presenting that same antiquated sign of wealth that comes from England.
Mm.
But what you want to be able to do is garden on your land to provide food security for yourself. You should be able to have that thing in the backyard and the front yard and everywhere else. But because we're trying to emulate something that we don't even, that doesn't even apply to us, we right. have this issue. And so I just got mad all over again.
And that, but that's a point of advocacy because that's a policy that is not going to work in this new climate-sensitive future where more people will need to have that flexibility over their land. And truth be told, our footprint for our neighborhoods, the one, you know, the ones, not so much the organic ones that came from an old city and you just spread out, but like a new suburb. I'm not even quite sure what your land can handle, but it still doesn't mean that that policy is going to stand in the face of the reality that the land might need to be repurposed. Because like you said, it was started, you know, to be a reflection of your wealth. But if the reality is that you need to repurpose your land to increase your food security, that wouldn't just be you, you know, not you personally, but that wouldn't just be one family. That might be 10, 15 families who are like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, I got to do more here locally because I'm tired that produce that I'm getting that I'm not aware of what it takes for it to get to me. If that's your personal conviction, then you should be able to respond in a way that's sustainable on what you pay for. But HOAs are the devil anyway. I don't deal with one, so I wouldn't have known that.
We've been so conditioned to think in those terms. So for instance, we value single species grass or lawns. So like you want mm-hmm. your tall fescue, you want your Kentucky bluegrass, you want what, but you want it all to be one thing instead of how things grow in nature where they interact mm-hmm. with each other and grow healthy. So you don't want your crabgrass because that's a different type of thing. And we've been conditioned to think that crabgrass is a weed like clover is a weed. Clover is not a weed. It doesn't need weed killer. That just bolsters a weed killing industry. That doesn't mm-hmm. do, you should be able to grow many types of natural grass on your lawn, but for some reason we don't understand it this way. And so what we do is pay somebody to drive to our house, burning fossil fuels, to cut our lawns using burning fossil fuels mm-hmm. and to go away and to not have the diversity of plant life that we should have in our yards, because we also paying for fertilizer, which also impacts the environment. There's a lot of things that are connected that we can start to think through. And a lot of stuff comes from European being the default.
Absolutely. I think just before we overwhelm with all of the many things that you could do, I think that the charge here is to actually think through it and to think through what are those changes that maybe I can make individually or for my family or within my community that I can be consistent with. Because some people don't even get that far in the process because they're overwhelmed by how many little interconnected pieces there are. But we have to go beyond that. And to my point earlier, that's why I said we're actually training our kids. We might be unlearning a lot of things because it's how we came up. And, you know, even with the warning is not the actual consequence. So I think that one, our charge is to train our children. The second charge here is when you're thinking about it, it's not so much thinking about the tangible problem, but imagining new solutions. And that is something that we're going to have to do across a great many issues. We have to imagine something different because we've never had it before. We've never done it before. And when you say, well, where's the hope? I feel like the hope is in what you have yet to create, because what's already here is surely going to wither and unfortunately die. But some of it needs to. And as much as we talk about upheaval and revolution and all of these things that just mean change on a huge, huge scale, the core of that is imagination. I know what it is. I know what my reality is. But as a man thinks, so he is. So my thing is, think something new.
So you advocated for staying together, staying near our infrastructure and all mm-hmm. of those things. What we may see in the near future, 20, 30 years, is that gravitation towards the interior of the country, where New York, LA are no longer the hubs of fiscal social activity. But you see more things like Chicago, Cleveland, those cities will become more prominent as more mm-hmm. people gravitate towards those things. And so I am also an advocate of being around us, because we've been safe for us. Usually, like, and so it's just good. But I want to offer, you may want to consider making a move. So the traditional wisdom for Black people in this area, I don't know what it is like where you all live, but these Black people retire, they work in these the DC area, they take this DC retirement south, and maybe go to North Carolina, where land is cheap.
Like kings. And
yeah, because uh-huh. they can take that retirement and do great things down there. They can afford more house. They can afford more land, etc. Problem is, we're already seeing it in Texas, that the land is, the southern states are becoming hotter. And as I think Texas is up to 40 days now where it's not safe to be outside out of the year. And so that's going to happen across the southern states. So you may want to think about taking that money, that retirement money, somewhere else in places that we are not, but that is not usually safe for us.
Right.
But that doesn't mean you can't imagine a way to safety. So for instance, you may want to get together with a couple of your friends, like four or five of y'all, three or four families, right. Say, hey, listen, let's go get these acres at this place and figure out how to do that. The land right mm-hmm. now is very cheap, and you'd be surprised how cheap it is until you actually look. Because it's poor people in the South, but it's also poor people in the mountains. So that means the land is cheap all of those places. Mm-hmm. And it's not as safe, or it's not as Black in the mountains. If you wait until all the Black people are there, it's going to be more expensive by the time
late.
You're... Yeah.
It's too late.
So, yes, we are safe around us, but you may want to consider something else.
Also, do what's within your means to do. So exactly. just like we're saying this, as far as, you know, maybe you want to look at living in a different place, living in a different way in a different place. if you consider yourself a traveler, you like to go to different locales and experience culture, a lot of that is not new to you, you know, on a cellular level, on a spiritual level. A lot of it is a reintroduction to culture that you've been separated from. To that, I say, at the level that you are able to do something and be consistent with it, you might also want to look at what it means to have a location to go to, if not a full relocation and living there, but having a location to go to that's different. That movie, Day After Tomorrow, everything went crazy. I know in the last like few scenes of the movie, it was the whole thing about people relocating to countries that in the previous economic hierarchy owed money to the richer countries. But now these countries were safe climate wise and safe from natural disasters for people to come to. And now all of a sudden the people who used to welcome immigrants were the immigrants themselves. And yes, that was a point made on purpose and, you know, made for us to think. You don't want to wait to see what that's like when it's going down, right? And there are some people who might hear this and be like, oh my God, you guys are so late. You should have been doing this 30 years ago. Well, we're telling y'all now that if you travel to different places, if you are one who is open to different countries at different times of the year, and you're open to how other people are living, now is as good a time as any to case those locations out, to figure out what it would mean for, again, you're doing this not just for you, but for your kids.
Right.
What would it mean for your kids to go there to study abroad or to go to university in a different country, to learn a different way of living? I'm not saying that America is not producing this same type of knowledge or that we cannot do these things here. I'm saying that people who have more options and more resources are people who have more options and more resources.
Yes. So this will definitely exacerbate the socioeconomic gulf that we see.
Yeah.
So you're right. Some people may not be able to do it. But what I want to encourage you is that when we look back, let's say we do our genealogy research, a lot of times we find that people much poorer than us were still able to secure land. Yep. Because the land by itself is not terribly expensive, depending on where you get it. And so I learned this, you know, when I first bought my first house, because it was like, how do you buy a house? It's so much money. You don't know until you look. And then you usually find, oh, this is actually doable. I may make some adjustments, or I may, like I said, you may have to go in with some friends or family members or whatever. And that's actually better, because it's better to, if you drop it in somewhere where it's not a lot of you, you're not dropping in by yourself. So there are ways to creatively think about this. And I like the way that you put this, that we have to be able to dream in a better way. And those who dream first and biggest will thrive. Those who are waiting to see if it's safe or if this is the right thing or are people going to do it and all that stuff, maybe they can afford to do it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people can't. So imagine what your life could be like.
Right.
If you made the change instead of being forced to make the change, because by then it's way too late.
Absolutely. And for those, you know, again, we probably could have done numerous shows on this because the problem isn't really going anywhere. But just like we speak to those people who might have the means or the opportunity, the heart to do something else. For those who don't have that, it doesn't mean that you just have to take what comes. Again, getting back in touch with your rooting, with how your community has thrived in less than stellar situations previously, how we collaborated, you know, not just one house to another house, neighbor to neighbor, but also through our institutions, a church family, you know, an alumni group, an affinity group, how we've navigated difficult challenges. That is solid information. So as much as I say, you know, I said to a group of people earlier, stay close in these cities, stay close to your infrastructure, stay close to your transportation and opportunities that come because they're strength in numbers. I'm saying that when you take that and you combine that with reusing and repurposing items in your home, and you combine that with committing to using public transportation twice a week, you know, and leaving your car at home, and you mix that in with choosing four local shops to shop from, to walk around and shop from, and figure out what's in your community and what needs to be there. Some of us don't know what's in our community and what needs to be there because we're constantly driving out of it to go to other places. But if you said, I want a grocery shop and I want to be able to carry my two bags back to my house, you would figure out that you live in a food insecure, very expensive neighborhood that has no supermarket. You have other homes, but you have no place to buy, you know, food or a flashlight or something that you might need. But there are ways to do this. And I think what I want you guys to understand from us is that we recognize the power of self, but we know that we are absolutely divine when we collaborate. Mm-hmm. When we collaborate and combine, magic happens. God moves, you know, and that's not a throwaway statement. God moves when we get together. Mm-hmm. And we're making the argument that y'all need to get together so God can make a move that will help sustain us on this earth. Like, it's our conversation is nothing like what this podcast recording is, but it's similar. And it's important to know who is of like mind and who is of like heart and who is of like spirit when you're trying to tackle some of life's bigger questions.
Yeah, so this is one of the biggest questions. And so we are going to talk about this in other shows, and we're going to be doing other things. But this is that important. So please, hopefully you take something that we said. If you don't take anything that we said, take this. Vote like this is that important.
Okay, because I didn't even get to go right back there, but we'll touch
so
on
we got
it again.
So we got other shows to do. Yeah. But we can get through this show. Like, we can do this. Or not. But it won't be because we didn't try. So
it's going down anyway.
For Faith Uncut, I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.